this episode of the Insights Podcast on the Acadia Broadcasting Network. I'm Don Mills.
And I'm David Campbell.
David, that was quite the conversation with the new president, well, new since August of last year, of Dalhousie University, Dr. Kim Brooks. I've known Kim a little bit for a while. She's one of those good choices that universities sometimes make. Usually they bring somebody in from outside to lead the university. In this case, they pick somebody with deep understanding of the university, who had been both the dean of the Faculty of Law and the Faculty of Management, to be the president. She's a breath of fresh air, I think is the way I would put it.
So I talked to a university professor, president a long time ago, probably over a decade ago, and he told me it's not the role of university to meet workforce demand in a jurisdiction. And he was actually resenting the fact that the provincial government was trying to tie their investment to some sort of workforce objectives. And I understand there's a line there, but it was really exciting to hear her talk about the role of the university in helping drive economic growth in Nova Scotia. I've never heard a university professor, at least that I've talked to, care about GDP per capita. And she actually talked about how Nova Scotia was at or near the bottom of the table in North America in terms of provinces and states. So that alone is an indication that she sees the university as a catalyst to try and help drive economic growth and population growth in Nova Scotia and across Atlantic Canada. And that kind of gave me goosebumps, and the rest of the interview followed up from that for sure.
Yeah, no, it's a very insightful interview in terms of understanding the strategic direction of the university. Kind of where it is right now. It's a big economic enabler. It's a big talent attractor through immigrations and foreign students coming into the university. It's really important from a research and development point of view as well. I hadn't realized this, but we've talked about this before. Most of the research being done in Atlantic Canada is being done through the universities. In Nova Scotia, 80% of that is happening at Dalhousie. So they're a big research player. They've got a lot of interesting research going on, focused on sustainable oceans, sustainable food, climate. They've got a lot of expertise, and they're leveraging that. And the other thing that is worth noting is that they're playing a bigger, increasingly bigger role in the startup communities, through the Creative Destruction Labs, and who we've had on the podcast in the past, their involvement of Cove, their involvement with the setup of the Canada's Ocean Supercluster, both of which we've had on this podcast to go in some depth, and other things. And so I think they're understanding that they have a bigger role in terms of the future of this province in this region. And I think we should all be really excited about that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does look like that's showing up in the data. We are seeing an increase in the number of startups in Nova Scotia in these areas, whether it's life sciences or ocean tech and related technologies. And a lot of those folks are either coming out of research based at the university or coming out of just students graduating from Dalhousie and starting new companies. So I think that's an exciting role. She gets that. She's very passionate about that. Obviously we took this interview, Don, in the direction of economic development. We could have took it into some of her other priority areas, but there's no doubt that she sees the university again as a catalyst for supporting population growth and economic development.
And I'm very pleased that she's continuing on a strategic direction that her predecessor started as a civic university, which really means more engagement with the community in which it resides. This has been a bit of a problem for Dalhousie for a long time. They have not been as well connected to the community as they should be. And in this direction, I think more universities are doing this now anyway, but they need to understand that they have a bigger role than just educating students. They have an economic development role that we heard in this conversation that I think will stand us in good stead if it continues.
Yep, and helping to solve you know, social challenges and all these other issues. And again, you know, Dalhousie is well positioned to help with all of those things in the community.
So the final thing I want to say, and I really, I mean, it came through, and it should come through to anybody listening to this, having the unbridled enthusiasm of a Kim Brooks must do wonders for an institution like Dalhousie University. And I'm hopeful she can retain that unbridled enthusiasm as she makes her way, you know, through her term as president.
Amen.
So with that introduction, here is our most interesting conversation with Dr. Kim Brooks, the president and vice chancellor of Dalhousie University. On this edition of the Insights Podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Kim Brooks, the president of Dalhousie University. Welcome to the podcast, Kim.
Hi, Don. Nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
First, congratulations on your appointment as the 13th president and vice chancellor of Dalhousie University. You were the first female president of the university. Can you tell us what that means to you personally?
Yeah. Hi, David. You know, it's a good question, and one I've been asked by a few people, of course, probably not surprisingly, in the first couple of months. And it's interesting that it's still something remarkable and a question, you know what I mean? Like, it's, I'm surrounded everywhere I go by incredible women leaders in a variety of different places. And so I try not to make too big a deal of the fact that I'm the first person at Dalhousie. It's taken us a while to get onto that train, I guess. But otherwise, excited to be here, happy to be part of, I think, quite a diverse team of folks at Dal, and ready for what comes next.
So you were appointed as president and vice chancellor in August. While you are new to the role of president, you are certainly not new to Dalhousie. Can you give our listeners a little history of your sort of personal career track, where you were born, how you ended up at Dal, and then ultimately as president and vice chancellor?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've had the chance to see a lot of the country. I was born in Saskatchewan, so that gives me a kind of grassy start. And I've spent time at University of British Columbia and Queen's University in McGill, so sort of bumped my way across the country in a variety of different institutions. But I came to Dalhousie in 2010 to serve as the dean of the Faculty of Law at the time, and I spent some time in that faculty, which was great, and then had a really unique opportunity to spend some time as the dean of the Faculty of Management, which was just a joy, and then kind of made my way from there into the president role.
Kim, one of your biggest advantages is that you know Dalhousie intimately, having served in those senior roles as dean of both the law school and the Faculty of Management. I wanted to ask you how that advantage has helped you in your new role as president of the university.
Yeah, Don, it's actually probably a harder question than you might think, even asking it. And I'm still trying to make sense of that advantage. It's really unusual, I think, for a president to come in at a university with substantial experience already at the institution. I think the last person here with that set of circumstances was maybe Andy Mackay. And then to also have had experience in a couple of different faculties. And I'm trying to think about how to make sure I make good use of that in the activities and actions at the university. But one of the things it gives me for sure is a familiarity with the folks who are connected to the university in a way that other presidents might not have had. And I think that does give me a kind of rich ground from which to start to think about how we can enhance those partnerships, what new things we can do together, what difference the university can make, and to really hit the ground running in that kind of proverbial sense in a way that would be very atypical.
You know, I've had a lifelong association with Dalhousie, and I do not recall another appointment of a president of the university that has been so universally received by the university community. Clearly, there are high expectations with your appointment, perhaps maybe even higher than normal because of that familiarity with the institution. Do you feel any pressure based on the high level of goodwill that you start your term as president with?
Don, Yes, of course I do. And when I first started, there was I received all kinds of support from a range of different quarters, which I'll tell you bolsters the spirits. And I don't take it lightly, because I know in the role as president, you've got to take decisions that, you know, inevitably will make some people less happy than others over the course of time. And so you have to enjoy moments of support when they arise, for sure. I had a kind of humbling moment where I was sort of trying to think to myself, what would it be about my past trajectory that might have created that sense of enthusiasm? And then as I talked more to people, I realized that a lot of what people said is, look, we're just so excited to have someone internal who knows the university well, you know what I mean? And so I've come to appreciate that it's less about me and more about, I think, the past experience I've got. And that makes it a little bit easier, I think, to stand in the face of those expectations.
One of my experiences, I was on the board for quite a while, and I got to know the university from a bit of an inside perspective, and discovered that universities, I guess I knew this a little bit before, but it really got cemented, are very difficult organizations to run, very political, actually, with all the different faculties and the unions and that sort of thing. What are the specific challenges that you find because of the pure size and the fiefdoms that exist within the university?
Yeah, I mean, we're hugely complex organizations, right? We kind of run on a collegial governance model, which means we have a whole bunch of different component parts of the university who sort of, in some sense, run themselves under the kind of larger umbrella of the university. And you've identified some of those kind of key groups, I think, in thinking about unions, but also faculties and units, Senate, the board. And so you're trying to listen to where all of those people are at, think about what the university can offer to the province, the country, the world, and then figure out how you can bring folks together with shared commitments and directions. And so it's really the leadership role, I think, is really about listening, hurting, and then pressing forward, I think, in the face of a variety of different perspectives and opinions. And there are all kinds of, articles and books that talk about the impossibility of moving universities forward. And every time someone publishes one of those, I get copies sent to me by friends of the university, I think, hopefully not to discourage me, but instead, I guess, to sort of spur me to sort of think about, are there ways through some of this quagmire? But all of that is part of what makes it so interesting to serve as the leader of this kind of institution, I think, is you really do have to see yourself as rooted in the Dalhousie community and understand that community as both the kind of employees, students, but the broader stakeholder community. And that includes, like, in its broadest sense, Don, and I'm really trying to wrap my head around this, like, what do Nova Scotians need from Dalhousie? And I think those are really big questions that not every institution has to ask, but as a public institution, I think we have to grapple pretty seriously with.
Of course, Dalhousie is the largest university by revenue and research income in Atlantic Canada. It is the anchor of a major post-secondary education cluster in Halifax, probably for a city of its size, the highest concentration of post-secondary education in the country. With that said, you recently released your most recent five-year strategy. Can you give us a sense of the top goals of that strategy?
Yeah, I mean, so here's a good thing to sort of build from Don's question, I think, into yours, David. The universities are complex places, but the mission and direction of universities is not that mysterious, right? We have to produce excellent research. We have to train outstanding talent, and we have a kind of community commitment. And so every university strategic plan that you pick up across the country doesn't look that dissimilar. And so ours has kind of five core planks: an exceptional student experience, high impact research, you know, to serve as a civic university with global impact. And then I think what's I think a bit unique about where we've headed is to really focus on inclusive excellence, which I think is a kind of framing about what it means to be a diverse and inclusive community, but to be pursuing, I think, outstanding distinction. And then to try to think about how we, another sort of focal point for us is to just try to think about how we run this university well. So how we have the right foundations, I think, for that inclusion and distinction in the university. And so, that's a strategic plan, as you said, that runs from 2021 to 2026, and I'm quite happy to step into it. I think it sets us on a good foundational path.
Can we start by you sort of telling us what's different maybe from the past strategic plan, the last one?
Yeah, I mean, So it's, I'm in kind of an interesting position because often it's the case that when a new president arrives, they, you know, that they do a kind of conventional listening tour around campus and they talk to a whole bunch of stakeholders and then they come up with a strategic direction for the university. And because I've come in halfway through this strategic plan, you know, and I've been here and was here through the, its development, I just have the opportunity to kind of step into that strategic plan and continue to carry it forward. There's nothing that needs to be adapted about it, I don't think. But it does give me a chance in the kind of president role to think about where I'll focus my time and energy. And so I think I'm in a little bit different place, I think, on that one than previous presidents. And you know, so we're spending our time, or I'm spending my time in particular, on three different things. First, really thinking about how the people at Dalhousie are doing. And that includes the students, faculty, staff, but also the kind of close partners that we have. And lots of organizations are doing this, right? The return from COVID, you know, while we all want to pretend that it's kind of everything is fine and we're back into whatever we would call a new normal, in fact, there's all kinds of hangover effects of that period of time that have been dramatic. And so trying to make sure we create the breathing room for people to really think about where they're at and think about how they want to engage with the university. The second is to really think about place. And I think that is a bit of a new focus for Dalhousie, and to really care about what it is that we are bringing to Nova Scotia. And so, you know, one of the questions I ask myself as a kind of test question, and not with hubris or thinking we're in fact responsible for this on a kind of real level, but is what would we be doing as Dalhousie if we felt truly responsible for the success of Nova Scotia? And I think all of our big institutions should be asking themselves that. And so I think that's a bit of a new focal question for the university, and it's one I'm interested in exploring with colleagues as we go. And then the third one is thinking a little bit about purpose and just trying to think about what does it mean that we're a university? What is it that we expect universities to be able to do? And I think that one actually has turned out to be more important than I thought when I was first crystallizing it as a focal point in August and September, in part because of all of the kind of geopolitical challenges that we have seen, you know, where I think we do need to ask ourselves as a university, what role do we have to play in supporting people and thinking about some of the really complex things that are going on in the world.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up on your second point there around place? Because it does seem to me that a lot of universities chafe at that that sort of strategic priority. In fact, I've dealt with university presidents that have said it's not our role, you know, to solve labor market challenges, for example, in the province. Our role is to create talent for the world or whatever. Because there has been an attempt, of course, in recent years to try to align university graduates with the actual demand in the workforce a little bit better at that. We're trying to be a little bit better at that. So why do you think that matters, and why do you think maybe some universities aren't as focused on that?
Yeah, so I mean, let me give you just a basic starting point that I find helps ground me when I think about this. Like, again, if you take a look at the kind of, you know, GDP per capita of all of the provinces and states, you'll find Nova Scotia at the very bottom. I mean, we are the last, And I think that's kind of remarkable. Like, we can contest all kinds of things about GDP per capita as a metric and doesn't mean anything and should we be chasing it. And I'm happy to have those conversations on a different podcast. But I, you know, but I think as an institution that, so here's one thing we know about university institutions. People who obtain university degrees have higher incomes. That's just very clear. And the more of those university degrees they get, the more the incomes increase. So here we sit in a province, you know, as one of the primary drivers of income for folks as they, you know, enter the workforce. And yet we sit in a province where we have the lowest GDP per capita. And I feel like we should feel some responsibility for that. I mean, I think we need to think as an institution about how do we bring the right talent who can kind of command the right type of both engagement, joy in their work, but also a kind of, you know, good living once they get through university education. There's lots of ways in which I think universities need to be see themselves as making a difference in the economies in which they find themselves. But that's just one very simple example where I think the data that surrounds us should give us pause and should make us ask, like, what can we be doing differently?
But I think that's a great question. One of the very interesting issues is that Nova Scotia has always overgraduated university folks from university compared to the rest of the country on a per capita basis. but it hasn't necessarily translated into a higher university graduation rate in the workforce. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. Is that because we're not doing enough to sort of translate that into opportunity in the community, or why are we seeing such leakage?
Yeah.
In university graduates, and I'm sorry to throw such a difficult question at you this
No,
morning.
David, look, if any of us had the right answer to that, we'd hopefully be able to fix it. So but I do think there are some guesses we can make, and I think as an institution, you know, we've tried to take some of that on board and see if we could do some experimenting with it. And so I think about someone like a former president, Richard Florizone, who was kind of core to a group of folks who said, how do we better mobilize a kind of an innovation ecosystem in this region, right? And what would it take for us to really think about how we would motivate and inspire kind of more small business, more entrepreneurialism, and more successful small business and entrepreneurialism in the region. And so I think that's the kind of thing that universities can do as they think about how we can provide the right conditions in this region for people to truly be successful on graduation. And I think there's lots for us to do. I mean, we might talk more about this over the course of the podcast, but thinking about things like what can we be doing to support the expansion of a green hydrogen sector? What can we be doing to be thinking about, you know, how we cultivate the right talent in science, in the arts, like all of those kinds of things. And then, you know, hopefully work with partners. Universities clearly can't do all of it. I think the other presidents, when you talk to them, are right about that. We can't do all of it. We have to be doing it in collaboration, I think, with the private sector, with governments, you know, with community groups. But we do need to take it on as though we're responsible for it.
I remember a conversation with your predecessor, Dr. Deep Sant, and when he came in, he had a slightly different, focus from previous presidents. He talked about the civic university, which I really liked. I've always felt, or I felt for some time, that the universities seem to be a bit disconnected from the community in which they were supposed to be serving. You've already referenced that. I wonder if you, and you've already outlined that being a civic university is still a priority for you, a focus for you. Maybe you can explain for our listeners what that actually means.
Yeah, I mean, Don, I think we're still feeling our way about that. And I think it was an interesting way in that last strategic plan for DEEP and others to kind of crystallize the idea that the university has obligations to the community around it, and we should embrace those, be explicit about them, and hold ourselves to a standard of delivery on that. And that is, at least at a kind of, you know, a sort of standard narrative, it is a bit of a shift, I think, for universities to think of themselves that way. And I think that shift has been happening across a number of universities over the last, say, 50 years. But I think the goal for us, or the kind of call of responding to being a civic university, asks us to really think about what difference we make in the community and communities in which we're engaged. And I think that's just an ongoing conversation here. And I think we need to welcome and be open to feedback from those communities about what it is that they think we can be doing that will make a difference.
Yeah, I like it, by the way. I think I'm really pleased about that direction. I think it's important. I want to just shift gears a bit and talk about the economic role that the university plays. Big employer, obviously. And it plays an important economic role, not just in Halifax and Nova Scotia, but really across the region. I wonder, has the university conducted an economic impact study of its contributions to the economy recently?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we've done some economic impact studies in the past, and the sector, certainly through the Atlantic Association of Universities or the Council of Nova Scotia University Presidents, does them occasionally. And I think they all yield kind of the same result, which is that there's no question that universities have a major economic impact. Everything from, you know, jobs to the money we spend in the sector to the students we bring in to the export of university education. All of those things, I think, study after study just kind of gives you that viewpoint of what the universities do. But of course, there's nothing really surprising about that, Don. Like we're a big institution. Dalhousie in particular is a big institution, and any big institution is going to have that kind of impact on a region or a sector. And so I don't think we have, you know, again, probably this is a little less doctrinaire maybe than others, but you know, you would just expect that of us. If we weren't having that impact, I think you'd be worried, as opposed to the other way around. I think that's just a normal consequence of being the kind of size that we are, with the kind of employment and student activity that we have.
So let's talk about numbers a little bit. What is the budget of the university this year?
Yeah, so there's kind of two pieces to the budget. There's the operating piece to the budget, and the operating piece is just over 500 million. And then the total consolidated budget, which includes, you know, research and other things, is about 900 million.
That's a big number, yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that, you know, the university is a major employer, obviously. Let's tell us how many jobs, both on the faculty and staff, are currently in place at the university.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is always a bit hard to keep track of, Don, because there's a fair amount of mobility in terms of some of the workforce. But this headcount at any given time runs somewhere between 6,500 and 6,800 employees. That includes part-time and casual staff in the mix. And that has a payroll amount, I think, of about a little over 400 million. So it's a pretty big number.
I wonder, does that not make the university, outside of the government, the largest employer in Nova Scotia? It must. Yeah,
that's a good question. I don't know whether that's true, Don, but it would be up there for sure.
Yeah, we did a podcast with Michelin not that long ago, and I think, David, they had 3,600. So you're a long way above that. So that's a big number. I just wanted to follow up on that. Do you have, I think you mentioned, you know, that you included a variety of jobs in their staff and contractual, I suppose, and others. But do you have an estimate of the indirect jobs that are supported by the university, you know, maybe through what it spends in the community? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, it's funny. We don't track that, and it would probably be tricky to track. I mean, think about all of the external folks we engage to kind of support activity at the university. There's, like, you know, the support that students would offer to folks in the economy that would result in jobs, for example. Downtown Halifax. So I think we don't take a shot at trying to make sense of that. But again, you know, it would be a substantial impact, I would have thought, in terms of the indirect employment consequences.
A few years ago, I took a look at the economic impact of in the sort of area around Dalhousie University, and the census tract or dissemination area, I can't remember which one, was the youngest or the top five youngest in the entire country. I think the median age was like 24.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Compared to, you know, the province at whatever it is these days, 45, 46. So that sort of youth and vitality and vibrancy in that part of the city is just amazing. And also that now the university sector is the largest export sector in the province, Don, even ahead of Michelin. So that's very interesting if you look at interprovincial and international flows. But we just wanted to ask you a little bit about your supply chain. Do you have any sense for us on how much you spend annually on goods and services purchased in Halifax or other parts of Nova Scotia?
Yeah, it's a good question. It varies, of course, by year, but so we know that the total non-salary spend is between 300 and 400 million a year. We don't track it, you know, what the spend is in Halifax or Truro or Nova Scotia versus other places. And actually, it's a good question, and that would probably be helpful data for us to see if we could take at least a guess at it in terms of being able to show. In some ways, maybe to drive our decision making a little bit about where we're actually seeking goods and services. Yep.
So, how about income tax? Do you have, from any studies that you've done, have you tried to induce how much you pay the government in income taxes?
Because I'm a tax person, I'm always willing to take a stab at that, but it would just be a stab. So my guess would be that we're looking at about 100 million in total in income tax paid. And then the provincial portion, of course, would be just a percentage of that. I'd ballpark it at around 40%.
Well, that's a pretty good number.
Yeah, if you rolled in HST and you rolled in property tax and everything else,
that's right. Number. It would creep up. Yeah.
Let's turn to the student side. What's the current enrollment at Dal?
Yeah, so in this year, it's a little over 21,000.
Oh,
Yeah.
Trying to think how many were going there when I went there. It's a long time ago, but it was a small number.
Yeah, I think it's probably changed a fair amount. And although it's not changed, I mean, it's been relatively, it's kind of grown in small amounts over the course of the last number of years. There hasn't been kind of a big leap in students in recent time.
Yeah. You know, we talk about the impact of the university in terms of attracting people to this region. How many, what percentage of the student body comes from outside the province of Nova Scotia? Do you know that number?
Yeah, I do. So we have about 37% come from Nova Scotia. So the rest of them come from outside of the province. And that's a mix, of course, of students who would come from the rest of Atlantic Canada, from, you know, the rest of Canada, outside of Atlantic Canada, and international students.
And let's talk about international students, because one of the changing roles of the university has been as a talent attractor, I think is the right term. And how many you have the most foreign students, I believe, but what's that number today?
Yeah, so we're at about 4,500 international students. That's about 21-22% of the total student body.
Yeah. Another question I wanted to ask you on that particular topic: the federal government has recently decided that they're going to reduce the number of foreign students coming to the country. Have you calculated what the impact that could be on your enrollment at Dell?
Yeah, we don't know yet, Don, with certainty. So the province and the feds have been negotiating the international student cap numbers, and I expect those will be, you know, we'll get information about what those look like imminently, like today, tomorrow. We're sort of in the zone of those being provided. And that will, the number that gets provided in Nova Scotia will help us get a more nuanced understanding of what the consequences might be for Dalhousie or any of the other universities in the province. You know, we're kind of cautiously optimistic that that in fact our numbers will about match what we have at this particular point in time. And so there's you know, there's been worries, I think, particularly in Ontario, where the change will obviously be the most dramatic, that it will have a huge impact on the international student cohort. But again, you know, I may be regretting these words tomorrow when we get a bit more detail, but our sort of preliminary assessment suggests to us that we'll probably end up with about the same number of students that we've currently got. And you know, I think as a province we can have good conversations about what that means, whether we would like to have more or less, or whether that kind of hampers the province's goals around growth and immigration because of the limit that we're sort of stuck where we are kind of basically now. And I think those are interesting conversations. And the more immediate pressure point for us, I think, is the bit of stalling right now in the processing of visas, because those have been put on hold until this new process is put in place. And I think, again, we don't have strong evidence about this, but our perception is that must be hampering at least a bit, you know, international students' enthusiasm for coming to Canada. And then, you know, the run-on consequences for us in Nova Scotia, I think at this point, are unknown. It'll depend a bit on how long that pause actually goes on. But on that front, we have had, I think, quite good conversations with the province. And I think Nova Scotia is quite enthusiastic to be able to move on processing visas as soon as we know what visas we're allowed to process.
Yeah. David and I have been talking about this a little bit in our podcast. But one of the things that we've suggested is that the province should have the final say on how many come to their province. And, you know, we've been disadvantaged in this region for a really long time relative to the rest of the country. We have a bit of a catch up, right, in terms of the percentage that come to our region. So, you know, that's what we should be advocating for, we believe, at least. The other issue that I wanted to talk to you about on this is, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about what the right percentage of foreign students should be at a Canadian university. And in this region, we have a very big variance in that, some as high as 60% or more, and some lower than where you are. Do you have any, I know this is a hard question, but in general speaking, what would be a good ratio of foreign students to the general Canadian population?
Yeah, like I don't have a theory about what that number might look like, Don. I don't have any worries about where our number is. I can say that from my experience here. Kind of figuring out from a policy perspective where you might want that number to sit would involve a cluster of people actually having a shared conversation. I mean, some of that would be a conversation with the province about what are they hoping for in terms of immigration and types of people coming to Nova Scotia, and how can we support and encourage bringing the types of folks here that the province is hoping that we'll have in terms of growing the workforce here, growing the talent pool in Nova Scotia, and so on. And then internally, we want to make sure that we can provide a really robust experience for international students when they come here, that they have the right academic supports, that they have access to housing, all of those kinds of things that we know make the educational experience meaningful and useful to people. And then it's about making sure that we have the right mix of people in classes so that the conversations are interesting, so the viewpoints expressed are diverse, so that people are learning from each other. And I'm really passionate about one of the things that having international students on the Halifax or Truro campus brings for students from Nova Scotia, for example, is a bit of an international experience without leaving home. And I think that really matters. Like when you look at things like enterprises in Nova Scotia's willingness to engage in international export, for example, some of that just comes from a kind of comfort with the broader world, right? And a sense that, you know, I can in fact figure it out if I'm going to be looking at what it means to do business in anything from Texas or Arizona to, you know, Shanghai to somewhere in Brazil. And some of that comes, I think, from just starting to feel a comfort level with other people around the world. And you can do that right on campus. And I think that's actually a very important part of what the university can provide.
Hmm. So I wanted to ask you about the percentage of funding from the university that comes from government, specifically the provincial government. Of course, universities are taxpayer funded, but can you give us a sense of that amount or rough amount?
Yeah, I can give you exactly that amount, but we get about 46.5% of our funding comes from tuition, and about 42% comes from the provincial grant. And that number kind of crossed over a couple of years ago. It used to be the case that more of it came from the provincial grant, but tuition now exceeds the amount of the tuition of the provincial grant.
Can you give us the denominator there? Is that the 500 mil budget, or is that the 900 mil with all the research?
That's the five. Yeah.
That's the five. Okay. Yeah. And do you have any sense of what share of that tuition revenue comes from international students?
Oh, I don't off the top of my head, but it wouldn't be hard to figure that out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like most universities, Dalhousie has a significant unfunded infrastructure capital deficit, or at least that's our theory here. How large is that current infrastructure deficit, and how is Dalhousie proposing to address it?
Well, you can confirm the theory just by walking around on campus if you want. It's not that hard to confirm. So, yeah, our deferred maintenance costs are over $500 million. They're high. That's not inconsistent with any of the other provincial. Well, it's higher than the other provincial institutions because we have I think 160 buildings on our campuses. But it's consistent, I think, with the sector, which has has a major challenge around deferred maintenance costs. And I think that is one of the challenges in Nova Scotia is, unlike at least some of our comparator institutions other places, the province doesn't have a kind of funding mechanism to deal with capital projects and deferred maintenance. And so, some of the other provinces have decided to set aside some funding to really try to address some of those gaps. And that it's just a challenge that we're kind of constantly dealing with is, it's a little bit of chewing gum and sticking it in holes. Like it's, you know, we sort of do the best we can to upkeep things, and we have a priority list, obviously, but that's a pretty substantial gap.
Kim, like all universities, annual fundraising and capital campaigns are important sources of funding for Dalhousie. I think you're about to launch a major capital campaign. I've heard that the goal is $1 billion over 10 years. I don't know if that's true or not, but I had some pretty good sources for that. Can you tell us what the priorities for that money will be used for?
Yeah. So, Don, I'm excited about this. And I'm excited about the campaign because I think it gives us a chance as an institution and in conversation with our partners to really talk about what we care about and what we think we can do collaboratively together. And that's like a really, that's a really fun conversation to be in. So lots of what we do in the institution, you know, we consult with people and talk to them, for example, about what kinds of, what are the workforce needs, what kind of programs can we develop and so on. But with a capital campaign, you're really working closely with a partner to talk about what are their kind of interests, passions, commitments, things that they see as possible in the university, and then trying to think about whether there's a good, you know, meeting of the minds in terms of the direction. And so it really is a, it really is a chance to set up a robust partnership with you know, foundations, individuals, institutions, and so on. And so, you know, we do that motivated, I think, by the core planks of our strategic plan. I mean, that's the kind of goal, is to keep driving the institution in that direction. But also, I think, in view of the broader vision for the university and our collective aspirations for where we want to see ourselves, not just by 2026, but in fact, you know, in a decade or in 25 years. And so, so anyway, that's all coming together. I think there will be a launch in Halifax on April 2nd and in Truro on April 4th. And so I'll look forward to seeing you there, Don.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm on the list somewhere for that. You know, so just a follow-up question on that. I mean, there's a lot of campaigns in the marketplace, right? And one of the things that I noticed, I've always felt about our region, is that we're disproportionately generous in terms of supporting things, especially with a relatively small population. I just wonder, you know, what you feel the conditions are for the launch of a major. This will be by far the largest campaign ever by a university in the region, and probably from a national point of view, it's right up there as well, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Like I think there are, so first of all, you're right on, in the sense that I think folks are enormously generous with their time and their money with the institutions in the region, and we're, you know, we're a major beneficiary of that generosity, and very grateful for folks for sort of seeing possibility in Dalhousie and being willing to be part of it. And you know, our reach is a little different, I think, than some of the other institutions, in the sense that, you know, as we talked about, you know, sort of a little shy of 40% of our students are in Nova Scotia and come from Nova Scotia, but we have students that come from other parts of the country and internationally as well. And so we have the, you know, the sort of ability, I think, to work with people from Nova Scotia, from the Atlantic region, from Canada, and in some cases, I think, from international places. And so we are, I think, having these conversations in a set of different environments. And that gives us, I think, a little bit of, you know, we're not sort of knocking on all of the same doors as all of the same people in the region. And right. And I think that does give us a little bit more scope to feel like we're not always tapping the exact same people in every campaign alongside every other institution, which is, I think, what you were asking.
Yes, that's it exactly.
Yeah.
Just switching again quickly to a new topic. You know, labor force is a big challenge for almost everybody we talk to. Wanted to ask you what you saw as the key trends and challenges in terms of recruitment of for the university, both in terms of students and staff today.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in that conversation too, Don, and everyone I run into is kind of talking about it. How do we think about how we attract people that we badly need to be able to do the kind of amazing work that we're hoping to do? And then the secondary piece, like, once we have attracted interesting folks, how do we retain them? And both of those questions are worth some time in thinking. You know, there's no question, as we're trying to attract talented faculty and staff here, that we are experiencing the challenge. The housing challenge is a major concern, not just the pressures here, because those pressures are experienced other places, but I think the challenge of people taking a decision in this environment to leave their house in Ottawa or Vancouver or, you know, Missouri or wherever, for that reason, to come to Halifax and purchase a house here. There's nervousness about selling houses in some markets and purchasing houses in other markets or finding rental accommodations. And so, you know, that's big. One of the things we come up against too when people are moving here is the challenge of finding a family doctor. It's amazing that people care about that, right? And they when they want to know that when they move somewhere, even if they don't have persistent health problems, which creates a different cluster of issues immediately, but they want to know that they're going to be able to get the health care that they need when they arrive there. So those are a bit external to the university, but we have roles to play, I think, in both of those challenges in the region. And then there's the kind of, you know, just all of the things folks are seeing, which is a change in the way workforce is employees are interested in working. And I think we can be quite responsive on that. We're able to be offer relatively flexible work in at least some types of jobs. And so that kind of hybrid flexibility is an option, again, not across all of our roles, but certainly across some of them. Trying to keep pace with inflation, the compensation challenge is enormous. I mean, our budget's not growing with inflation, but people's expectations for their salaries kind of understandably are. And so how do we try to offer things that might be valuable to people without necessarily matching the kind of inflationary pressures on wages? Again, nothing unique, I don't think, about those challenges. And then in the student side, I'd say many of the same things kind of resonate. So same concerns for students around housing, concerns for them around the financial cost of an education, family pressures on their ends, you know, as their parents, supporters, guardians are having all the same challenges around their wages, maybe not keeping pace with inflation and so on, rising competition around the world for student recruitment. You know, making sure that we can offer people the right kinds of employability, work-integrated learning co-ops that they might want with jobs that are sort of helpful, valuable, meaningful, connected to their programs and so on. So, you know, I don't think there's anything unique that we're seeing at Dalhousie in terms of the employee pressures or the student pressures relative to other institutions in the province, but they're certainly acute.
Just as an aside, you know what's happening in Quebec for McGill and Concordia. Bishops, where I went, did my undergraduate, got kind of carved out of that, thankfully. But they've seen a significant drop in out-of-province applications. Have you seen an increase as a result of their decrease?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, it's hard to track whether something is a result, but our domestic numbers are strong. You know, there's a few things kind of at play at the same time. The Quebec changes are kind of in motion. You know, there's concerns in Ontario, I think, about the reduction in their international students. So universities there are kind of redoubling efforts, I think, to keep Ontario students there. So different policy moves are creating different behaviors on institutions in other provinces, for sure.
So we're going to come back to the question of healthcare, because, of course, the lack of doctors and so on, healthcare professionals. You have a role to play there, of course, as the largest provider of healthcare talent in the region, but we'll come back to that. I wanted to ask you just one additional question around attracting and retaining newcomers. Do you have any specific initiatives that you're using to firstly to attract international students? How are you doing that? And maybe secondarily, are there specific things to help retain them inside the province?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're quite focused on both of those things. And the core for me on both of them is that we have to offer meaningful, robust programs with the right kinds of educational supports when students get here. In other words, there's lots of things we can do around, you know, effective marketing, outreach, all of those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, I think the university's reputation in the medium and long term turns on, are you offering something that's valuable and meaningful to students? And if you're not, I think over time that kind of hurts you. And so you can't lose sight of that. And so I think at the end of the day, we have to really stay attuned to the kind of quality of the programs that we're offering. But the other kind of core piece of that I think is really valuable for international students are the offerings that we have around work-integrated learning. And I think some of that is about international students, particularly those who want to stay here, being able to come and then have a kind of structured opportunity to work with you know, local industry, government, and so on, and have that kind of experience as part of their educational package so that when they graduate, they already have work relationships and they have a sense of belonging in the province. And we have quite a robust set of work-integrated learning opportunities across our programs, and we have some great co-op offices, and it would be fabulous to be able to expand those.
So I think the University of Waterloo claims that if everybody gets some sort of work integrated learning, what share of your students would be sort of classified in that category, actually having some sort of co-op or work integrated learning?
Yeah, it's a good question. We're aiming to have every student who comes here have at least the ability to do some kind of experiential learning, whether it's kind of directly in a workplace or not, I think will vary. And I think we're going to be able to do that in the near term, like under this particular strategic plan, there's a kind of core commitment to that. Off the top of my head, I don't know how many of those are actually co-op positions, but there are some programs, for example, the Faculty of Management BCom program, it's mandatory. Everyone does 3 co-op turns. And then there are other programs where it's optional, and so students can do it or may not do it. And then there's a couple of programs, I think, where we're hoping to start offering co-op opportunities.
So, of course, Dalhousie is a major research institution. I think the latest numbers I've seen, somewhere around $190 million in sponsored research income last year, which is a big number, obviously, in the context of this region. I think it's more than all the other maritime universities combined or something like that. So I guess, could you tell us a little bit about that? Can you confirm that number? What's the amount you've attracted in recent years? And give us a little sense of your key areas of research. We're excited to see the work done, for example, in battery, electric battery research, and some of these things that are internationally important. So can you give us sort of the budget number and the research priority areas?
Yeah, of course. So we're on the other side of 200 million now, about 210 million in the last year. We've got a strategic research plan that's just been refreshed, but we have kind of core focus areas in sustainable ocean, you know, healthy people, communities and populations, climate tech and clean energy, culture and society, sustainable food, and AI and digital innovation. And that, what those try to capture, I think, are areas where we know we have strength across, you know, many of the various disciplines in the university, but that doesn't, you know, what it doesn't tell you is that we've got, you know, a whole range of areas where we have depth of expertise because we have the leading expert in, for example. And so it you know, the goal of that strategy, I think, is to capture those kind of broad based areas. And then, you know, you've already, I think, hit on these, David. Like, we're the global leader in ocean research in Canada, and we're 20th in the world on that metric. The Transforming Climate Action Research Program was just funded $400 million, led by DALF, by the federal government. And so that's kind of an exciting piece. We've done a lot, I think, in what people kind of refer to as the I3V area. So infection, immunity, inflammation, vaccinology, and researchers there, I think, tackling issues that are important nationally and internationally. Obviously, you referenced Dr. Jeff Don's battery research and his team of folks, lots of strength, I think, in that area. And that's kind of a nice story. Like, I'll just pause there for a second. It's a nice story because I think we wouldn't necessarily have said, you know, if someone said to us, what kind of research should we cultivate because it will be important to Nova Scotia? I'm not sure anyone would have said batteries would have come up on their list. You know, it's not obvious. We're not the place where you get the component parts that make a battery. And so that we have this researcher that's then kind of attracted other excellent researchers, then excellent grad students, then those grad students have gone on, I think, to start companies in the region that are connected to the kind of work being done there. Like, that's a great story, I think, about how we diversify the kinds of things that are happening in Nova Scotia. And then obviously all kinds of other exciting developments around AI, you know, precision agriculture, influence of law in civil society, climate tech, green hydrogen. And like yesterday, I was down visiting the Hydrogen Applications Research Lab with the premier. And, you know, it just is exciting to see this momentum towards green energy in the province. And we're committed, I think, to being part of the important conversations going on here about what the province needs.
And if we could attract $15 billion in federal incentives, we might actually be able to attract an EV battery plant.
We could. You could really do some fun things.
Just one quick follow-up on the research side. I recently did some work on the life sciences sector and its growth in Nova Scotia. And I was surprised at the increasing number of life sciences-related startups. So coming out of the medical school and other schools. Is that just me, or has there been sort of a more deliberate attempt to try and foster startups out of the healthcare and life sciences spaces?
Yeah, I think we're really trying to do that. And I think that's part of, you know, President Richard Florizon's legacy here has been to really start to say to people, you know, how do we take some of the great research that's being done here, both by the researchers, but in some ways for me, more interestingly, by the graduate students that we're able to attract from around the world, and then how do we get them making contributions to the region in a way that is interesting, inspiring, helps cultivate those kind of, you know, meaningful work that is sort of well remunerated. And I think that's all quite exciting, but very deliberate.
As we've been finding out on our podcast, there's an increasing emphasis across Atlantic Canada on the startup business community, where there have been sort of new eyes, new ideas appearing and emerging through the universities in the region. Dell has both the Creative Destructions Lab and the Idea Hub as two examples of your work in this area. But Dell is also involved, I believe, in the founding of Cove and Canada's Ocean Supercluster. So you've been busy.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the university's efforts to increase the number of startups really across the region?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been a really fun part of the work we've done here. And one of my favorite things about serving as the dean of the Faculty of Management was getting a chance to be part of the work of CDL and getting to see that in action. And it is extraordinary. Like the first time I went to one of the CDL sessions, I was kind of blown away by the design and by the support that it provides to founders, but also the community it creates among the talented people that we have in the region, who then, you know, because of the chance to sort of sit together as part of CDL, then I think come up with separately, you know, new ideas, and it really does become kind of a hub and a generative sort of activity. And so those are just, I mean, you named already, Don, some of the things that we're doing. And the other thing I just put on the list is we run programming under the kind of label Lab to Market. And that's a national program that's run out of Dalhousie. And the goal there is to work directly with researchers in graduate and postgraduate positions to help them, you know, discover their passion for entrepreneurship, build that skill set, and then turn the ideas that they have as part of their graduate work into successful business opportunities. And that's a pretty exciting program, too, worth checking out.
You know, that leads nicely into my next question. Thanks for that. The commercialization of academic research in the region has generally underperformed other areas of the country. I want to ask you, how is that changing? Maybe this lab to market is a good example. And can you give us maybe an example or two of some real success stories that you can talk about?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say one thing that's a bit distinctive about Nova Scotia is that a lot of the R&D research is performed by Dalhousie. And so if you compare us to the rest of Canada, I think you would find that most universities, you know, account for about a third of the R&D research being performed in the province, with the private sector and a small amount being performed in government. But here, universities account for about two-thirds of the R&D that's being performed. And Dal, just particularly because we're the biggest, it's not, you know, I don't say this to like to toot our own horn unduly, but and the addition of the medical school sort of helps. We account for about 85% of that in the province. And so we're doing a lot of that R&D work and a lot of it, you know, we've started developing or have a pretty developed, actually, I shouldn't say that. We have a pretty developed suite of programs that help people then think about commercialization. And so I think that actually is oddly a distinct advantage for us in Nova Scotia, and that if we sort of looked at it as something different, we might be able to actually mobilize in a way that maybe is less likely in other provinces where the focal point for that work is a bit more diffuse. And we've already talked a bit about some of the things that have been going on. Batteries are obviously provide a good example. But there's a range of examples. CDL Atlantic has had over 160 startups go through it. They've created nearly $1 billion in equity value. But there's like Zen Bikes, Oxford Frozen Fruit, you know, ABK Biomedical. There's just like a kind of unending list of possibilities that we could point to, I think, where we're starting to show the type of success that we would like to see around the mobilization of R&D and commercialization.
So I wanted to come back to the question of healthcare. You early on in this interview, you talked about the complexity of a university and the ecosystem. And I think a lot of folks outside the university setting would just say, why don't you just double the number of doctors? Why don't you just double the number of nurses? Why don't you, right? Why don't you just sort of crank the dial because we've had 150,000 people move into this region just since 2019. An unprecedented level of population growth. So the sort of layperson is saying the healthcare, training folks should just crank up the dial. Can you tell us about your role in training healthcare professionals and what you're doing to increase that supply to meet this demand for population growth? A demand, by the way, that Don and I both think is going to continue well into the future. Both New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, all four provinces have very robust population growth strategies. I'm not sure everybody believes them. That's part of the problem. But what's Dalhousie doing to turn up that dial on the supply of healthcare professionals?
Yeah, David, it's a good question. Look, I'll give the province lots of credit for taking this challenge on, I think, with enthusiasm and just trying things. I mean, I think it's really hard to move the dial in a term appointment. And so kudos to the premier, I think, for trying a bunch of different things here. And of course, like the one of the natural instincts is, well, we can fix it by just increasing seats. But think about how long that pathway is, right? Like if I put a doctor in a seat today, we're not talking someone who's actually out in the field for another 5, 7, 8 years, depending on what the sort of path that they're taking is. And so that's a good thing to do because it helps us in the medium term, but it's not going to be enough to address the urgent issues right now. But there are, I mean, we're keen to be part of the solution here. And I think have been working with the province on a whole bunch of different things. We've expanded enrollments in a whole range of programs from nursing, medicine, medical ultrasound, radiology, respiratory therapy, new family residencies, new programs, physician assistance program. Last week, I was at the launch of that program. Super exciting. Certificate in RN prescribing, new master's in nursing, in mental health. Afrocentric Bachelor of Social Work cohort, the campus, the medical campus, obviously up in Cape Breton. And so it has been heady times, I think, in the health space at Dalhousie. And certainly when I talk to the deans of our faculties of health and medicine and dentistry, they're passionate about responding to the critical needs of the province. I think they're exhausted from responding to the critical needs of the province. And I think we all need to do our part to try to make a difference here because it matters enormously to people.
In this area specifically, you provide a disproportionate number of graduates into New Brunswick and PEI as well. New Brunswick, of course, doesn't have, a lot of these schools, ophthalmology, whatever. Have you received equal support from those two provinces in terms of new money to support the growth in the student population?
Yeah, so we have, I mean, it varies by different types of programs, but a success that I've watched, because it started right around when I started at Dalhousie, is the medical campus in St. John. And I think that has actually been quite an effective way of supporting doctors and their training in New Brunswick without... I think some of the major challenges that come with setting up a brand new medical school somewhere and creating kind of a rich connection between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. And again, I'm not the right person to talk about this because this is just me lounge chair talking about it. But it does strike me that the more we can do to create some synergies across at least PEI, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia in the healthcare space, the better we'll all be. Like, we are small regions and we need to share talent.
Kim, we're almost out of time. I just want to ask a final question. Looking ahead, what do you see the future of Dalhousie University to be?
Yeah, Don, I mean, I maybe this is just because I'm new, you know what I mean? I just have unbridled enthusiasm for what
really?
I think
I couldn't tell. Could you, David? I couldn't tell any of that.
And I don't think it'll be easy. I think the job we ask folks who work in universities to do is hard. I think the times are challenging. I think there are a number of quickly moving political variables that we need to accommodate. On the other hand, we know that most fundamentally, I think we provide research that has impact with distinction, I hope, and we are the kind of chief accelerator of talent, I think, across a number of different levels. And I just think you have to be optimistic about those things in this environment.
Well, Kim, I want to thank you for joining us on our podcast and providing us with such a good understanding of Dalhousie's social and economic role in the region. And we want to wish you every success in your new role as president and vice chancellor of Dalhousie University.
Thanks so much. It was nice to see the two of you again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
Listening to the Insights Podcast from the Acadia Broadcasting Corporation. Follow the show and listen to past episodes on your favorite podcast platform, like Apple or Spotify. If you've enjoyed the show, why not recommend it to a friend? Don and David will be back next week with another deep dive into some key issues in Atlantic Canada.